In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. Comrade.
How are you?
I'm doing
comrade.
Well.
Comrade, that's good.
That was a little subtle introduction to our guest, Dara Goldstein, who's been with us, I think, four times over probably the last 15 years or so.
And I love coming and talking to you guys.
Well, thank you. You've written a number of books, many of them bestsellers. Your first book was, I think, in 1983.
Good memory.
Yeah. There was that...
A Taste of Russia, or A La Russe.
A La Russe.
Yes. A cookbook of Russian hospitality.
And here we are some 36, 37 years later. You're still writing books, especially on Russian cuisine.
I am. It's rather surprising.
And you've been teaching for... almost that long, haven't you?
I taught at Williams for 34 years, but I've since retired.
And what did you teach?
I started out teaching Russian poetry, Russian literature, Russian language, and then I moved into Russian art. Then I had the opportunity to teach Russian culture and cuisine. And then I ended up teaching food studies in the sociology department.
And your new book is called Beyond the North Wind, Russia in Recipes and Lore.
So can I ask you, how did Russia come into your life, or was it always there?
I don't think it was always there, but my mother's parents were Russian Jews who fled in the early 20th century because life was not good for them there. And my grandfather died before I was born, but my grandmother would never say anything about life in the old country, and I was just curious about it. And when I started college, I decided to study Russian, and something about the literature, the poetry just grabbed me. And I don't think there was intentionality all along the way. When I applied to graduate school, it was in comparative literature. It wasn't in Russian. But I got this amazing letter from Stanford saying, we can't accept you in comp lit, but we'll give you a full fellowship in Slavic languages and literature. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. Yeah. And then it just kept burgeoning from there.
I was charmed by that reference you made to discovering some teacups when you were 5 years old that happened to be made in the USSR or something.
Oh, well, that was a wooden cup that had been wood-burned, and it had an image of a Russian Orthodox church on it that was painted in cream and brown. And for some reason, that cup, I think I was closer to eight, but it represented everything I thought was my heritage, my past. And for some reason, I treasured it. And then my little brother did a chemistry experiment in it, and there was some explosion with whatever I don't know what he put in there, but he destroyed the cup. And I was devastated because it felt as though he'd destroyed what was precious to me. And I took the shards, and I saw that on the bottom it said, made in USSR. Mm. And I knew that that wasn't Russia, the old country. And so my dream of my past was shattered at that moment.
What about the U.S. Information Agency? I thought that was an interesting part of the book.
It was fascinating. Yeah. How did you get there?
Well, I was in graduate school, and I was reading Russian extraordinarily well, but I couldn't speak it. So I decided what I needed to do was to go to Russia, which, of course, was the Soviet Union then. So I applied for this program through the State Department, which was the U.S. Information Agency. And starting in 1959, they had signed a cultural convention that there would be exhibitions, reciprocal exhibitions in both countries. And if you remember the great kitchen debates between Nixon and Khrushchev, they took place in the first American exhibition in Moscow, which was the American home, and they were in the kitchen debating the ascendancy of the two different systems. So when I did that in 1978-79, our theme happened to be Agriculture USA, which was very politically fraught because there was not ample food in the Soviet Union. And here we had early videos of, things that fill me with shame now, because they were videos of American grocery stores where we trucked in produce from California to New York in the middle of winter, and housewives could get whatever they wanted, and there was no awareness of what it tasted, or, the carbon footprint, or anything about sustainability that we're concerned with now. And it was really in their face. But I was there to represent America.
And were you wearing a little checkered apron?
No, but I was in charge of the pickles and preserves stand. Mm-hmm. And those specimens came from the Iowa State Fair. They were blue ribbon specimens. And I have to tell you, that was one of the coldest winters on record in Moscow in 1979. And over the course of the months we were there, those jars disappeared.
That's great.
Yes.
You know, I think people, you reminded me again, as I certainly, because you've talked about Russia with us in the past, we still in America have no sense at all of what Russian both culture and food are all about. I think, you know, the same, we apply the same things to Russia that I suppose they apply to us, that you only eat hamburgers in America or something like that.
Isn't that true?
Yeah, well, no. But they're very expensive hamburgers.
Exactly.
Now. which is the deal. But it is true that we tend to think, well, there's borscht, which, as you point out, is not Russian. And we'll talk about that, why it's not Russian. And vodka and, you know,
potatoes.
And potatoes and cabbage, mm-hmm. but little else. And it's not that way anymore.
It's not that way. And honestly, it never really was. Mm. I mean, there was this Soviet blip when food was pretty grim. But even then, people managed to find beautiful things for their table. And one of the purposes of this book is I really hope to open people's minds to the bounty that is there, especially in the very cold regions where you think it's so barren and there's nothing at all. Even with climate change, there's snow there for a good 8 months of the year. And it's really an extraordinarily rich and inventive cuisine because they had to gather during the short summer months and the short growing season, abundant harvests that they would put up, fermentation and mm-hmm. curing, and all of these techniques that intensify flavor and give deliciousness to things. It's very trendy now, but the Russians have been doing it for a good 1,000 years.
So in the beginning of the book, there was a little quote that I really loved, which kind of maybe just sums up what you just said. And it was the benefits of austerity. It was the benefits of austerity rather than its limitations that really helped define the unique foods and flavors that exist there.
And I very much think that's true. You take something that is very minimal and you know as a chef how you build flavor and how you build complexity. So you can do that with salt. You can do that with smoke. You can do that through drying. You can do that by culturing dairy products so that they'll last, and that gives this beautiful sour flavor to them.
You mentioned the quote that you were very fond of. The quote that I'm very fond of is the first one. Oh. Don't put off till supper what you can eat at lunch. Alexander Pushkin, 1834.
Yes, that also encapsulates the Russian love of excess. So you have these poles of belt tightening because the Russian Orthodox Church dictated almost 200 fast days during the year.
Oh.
This didn't mean that you couldn't eat anything, but it meant that you couldn't have meat, you couldn't have fats, you couldn't have dairy. So it was pretty much a vegetarian and almost vegan diet. But then you would have the feast days, and then you would go all out.
You really moved beyond, it seems like, your comfort level in the first chapter, and that is Chasing the Past, where you connected with your fascination with the Arctic area.
Yes.
And that was very important for you to explore that area of cuisine. Talk about how and where you ended up and what you found there.
Okay. So I have to say that I didn't intend to write another Russian cookbook. It wasn't something that I had thought about. It was my editor at 10 Speed who said, "Why don't you write another one?" And I think I burst out laughing. I said, "I've already written one. I've been there. I've done that." But then I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I realized that what I had described in my first book was very much Soviet life and then looking longingly back at the haute cuisine of the, you know, French chefs who were imported by the aristocracy. So I wanted to get at what was most elemental about Russia, the way they've been cooking for 1,000 years and those essential flavors. And where could I find it? So I was reading and thinking about it, and I happened upon Pliny and Herodotus and discovered that there had been this Greek utopia called Hyperborea, which means beyond the north wind. And that's where I got the title for the book. And they said, you know, if you go across this mountain range over the Carpathians and cross this river and then travel for X number of days, you will arrive at this place where Apollo liked to spend his winters, where the sun always shone, beautiful, tall, blonde people, abundance, and also, very importantly, the birthplace of technology. So over the years, Russian and Soviet geographers tried to trace this path, and they determined that it was Hyperborea was on the Kola Peninsula, which is about 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle. So I decided I had to go there to find the truth and the tall, beautiful, blonde people, who, of course, were the Vikings, and the eternal sun, which is the midnight sun in the summer, even if it's dark for much of the rest of the year. And what I discovered was that during Ivan the Terrible's reign, a lot of people from Moscow fled there, you know, to escape his depredations. And they took with them their culinary practices, many of which are still being practiced today, because it's not a place where you get a lot of tourists. The Mongols never occupied that part of Russia, so it has remained relatively pure.
And they're isolated.
Yes.
So they would have to grow and produce everything, almost, it would seem to me, that they cook there. Or...
No longer. I mean, the global revolution has come there, and it's quite sophisticated cooking that you can find. But yes, for many years.
So these villages are isolated from each other, and did you visit a lot of these towns in that area?
Yes, and I have to say that my age, and my husband was with me at our age, it was challenging to be on these very, very bumpy roads, having to ford streams and rivers at a certain time when it was possible in vehicles that didn't have very good
shock absorbers. So you were on a safari almost.
Yeah. But it was amazing. I mean, I think I really felt the isolation of these vast tracts of taiga, which is forest, and tundra, which is the, you know, where the lichen and the moss are, and villages that even one of the great surprises to me was even villages that were, say, 10 or 20 miles apart, they all made their own style of gingerbread. And since I had been traveling from village to village, I told them, I was like the herald who came, did you know that up the river they're adding cardamom to their gingerbread? And they're like, no, we never thought of doing that. So it was fascinating to see that they had their practices that they had retained.
So home cooks, you visited with home cooks. And what about restaurants? Are there restaurants of note in that area? And my third question, is there still a lot of foraging that goes on?
Well, foraging is in the Russian blood, in the Russian soul. I mean, it's a way of life. It's not just, let's forage. It's they have to go out. No, it's something that's taught from childhood. Mm-hmm. Even in the nursery rhymes, you learn about the different names of mushrooms, and you see what they look like in the illustrations. And you have to do it. It's like, you know, a biological urge and a marker of the seasons. And you gather and you put those fresh mushrooms, I mean, you eat them fresh, mm-hmm. but then you put them up for the winter. So yes, lots of foraging. Restaurants in the city of Murmansk, which is about 4 hours to the east of Norway, at the top of the Kola Peninsula, has two of the best restaurants I've ever eaten at anywhere in the world. And I have recipes from one of the chefs in the book. One is sort of more traditional Russian cooking that has been updated a bit and is very homey but extraordinarily delicious. And the other is like New Nordic, except that it's New Russian and it's very cutting edge. Arkhangelsk, which is the other big city up there further to the east, closer to Siberia, also has beautiful restaurants. In the villages, there are great home cooks.
And is your book going to suddenly make this a gastro-tourism destination like the Nordic cuisines have become over the last 10, 12 years?
I think it should be. And people in Arkhangelsk, the tourist agency, was really helpful to me because they're trying to set up a gastronomic trail. Oh. But I think it's challenging for, say, Americans to go there. And if you don't speak the language, I mean, a lot of people speak English.
And
there's
no internet or spas or.
Oh,
no,
better internet connection than we have in the Berkshires, I must say.
That's great.
Everyone has cell phones.
So can I read something
and
to
before
you,
that, you read it, can we take a break and we'll start with what you'd like to read? Beyond the North Wind, Russia in Recipes and Lore. This is the brand new book from Dara Goldstein. And of course, we will we will query her on her best vodka recommendations before the show is over. I'm Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen. We're in the KSRO kitchen with Dara Goldstein. Her new book is Beyond the North Wind, Russia in Recipes and Lore. And John had a quote he wanted to share with
us. I thought it kind of summarized the book in a way and also helps us who don't understand what food is like in that part of the world. And it was just a little quote, actually, in the introduction in which you said, Russia's culinary continuity happens to coincide with the diet most often touted as wholesome today, and that included things like whole grains, I'll quote you, whole grains rich in fiber, cultured dairy products, and fermented foods bursting with probiotics, vitamin-rich plants foraged in the wild. And I thought, oh, so now I get a sense they just don't go to their local Whole Foods and go shopping.
No. Although, actually, there are amazing grocery stores in the large cities with beautiful products.
That's interesting because what you hear about is Mediterranean and Asian and all these other cuisines as they're held up as these are the type of cuisines you should embrace. And no one mentions Russian cuisine as a.
I know everyone thinks it's potatoes, but you know, the potatoes are parvenu. The Russians were really scared of potatoes. Peter the Great introduced them in the early 18th century, and the peasants did not want to plant them because they have eyes and they grow underground. And so they have to be associated with the devil. And there were a lot of edicts from numerous czars and empresses, and there were peasant potato revolts. And it really wasn't until the mid-19th century that they were widely planted. So this idea that it's potatoes, I mean, there are potatoes and the Russians love potatoes and do great things with them, but it's not the basis of the cuisine.
You make the point that potatoes didn't come, as you've just said, until later because they came from the New World.
Yeah, exactly.
They weren't indigenous to it. Mm-hmm.
But if you ask the average person, including me, what I thought about Russian cuisine, I'd say, oh, well, it has all those rich dishes like beef stroganoff, because that was one that I started cooking when I was 17 years old.
Oh.
And I became very famous for that. And there's the veal dishes. And then there's borscht and potatoes and cabbage. And that's Russian cuisine.
Yeah. And so that beef stroganoff, the veal orlov, those are all French dishes, you know, with a Russian twist, using sour cream instead of fresh cream.
But only for the hoity-toities.
Yeah,
for
the aristocracy.
Who would get those kinds of dishes. Yeah.
The other surprising thing that people don't think about is that because you have these 3 months where the sun is so bright for 24 hours a day, the herbs in the Arctic are extraordinarily intense in flavor. Better than any Mediterranean herbs I've eaten. And everyone thinks it's a palate cuisine, but they use vibrant herbs. There's horseradish, you know, which has this great bite. There's a lot of sour tang that gives a brightness to foods. They love strong mustard. So it's quite a piquant cuisine.
So in the first chapter, which is drinks and sauces
and preserves
and preserves vodka. So vodka. there's a lot of space devoted to vodka and how important it is. And you make the point that there are many, many different kinds of vodka, that vodka isn't just a singular flavor or beverage, that, and you include some really fun recipes like the pepper vodka, mm-hmm. which sounds like you better be careful with that.
Well, I love to do vodka tastings because the Bureau of Firearms, Alcohol and Tobacco, or Alcohol, Firearms and Tobacco, whatever it's called these days, defines vodka as odorless, clear, I think they say flavorless, distillation. And the range of vodkas is extraordinary because you can make it from any number of different fermented, anything you can ferment can become vodka. So Tito's is a good example. I think it's a great vodka. It's made from corn, 100% American, gluten-free.
In Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. Yeah. Who would have thunk? It's really good. But the Russian vodkas are traditionally made with grains, so with barley and rye and winter wheat more recently.
So would you quote your cure for a cold using vodka?
Pepper vodka. Yeah. Okay. So pepper vodka is one of the favorite infused vodkas. And when vodka was first introduced to Russia, and there's this, controversy about whether it's actually Russian or Polish. I don't think that will ever be decisively figured out. But it was medicinal. And so you didn't just drink vodka. You infused it with different herbs for different ailments. One of the favorite infusions is with pepper, with peppercorns, but I like to use hot, fresh peppers. And if you feel a cold coming on, this is an absolute cure-all. You get ready to go to bed. You pour yourself a shot glass of pepper vodka. You wrap a warm scarf around your throat. You get a piece of sourdough black bread, which is very healthy because, it has the sourdough in it. You spread it with honey, which has antibacterial properties and also soothes the throat. And then you put some very thinly sliced fresh raw garlic on it, and that has tons of vitamin C. Crawl into bed. Take a bite of your little tartine that you have made, tartine a la Russe, and slug back the vodka. Get under the covers. You start sweating immediately. And by the morning, you wake up, you are cold free, you're invigorated. The only problem being that no one will come within 10 feet of you because you smell really strong.
That RX, courtesy of Dr. Dara Goldstein. Her new book is Beyond the North Wind, Russia in Recipes and Lore. We're thrilled to have her visiting us again a third or fourth time over the past dozen or so years. Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen. One of you will win an autographed copy of this beautiful new book at the end of the show. Well, we've worked our way down to chapter two. We need to talk quicker. The new book is Beyond the North Wind, written by Dara Goldstein. And the next one, it's an important chapter, ferments.
And isn't it interesting how in America, fermentation and ferments have finally hit the hit parade?
One of the things that I think really characterizes Russian food is this sourness. And when you say sour in English, it's sort of a negative word. Yeah, I mean, you think of sourpuss. Mm-hmm. But for the Russians, the sour is the desired taste.
Yeah.
So fermentation creates that. And I mean, it's one way to create that culturing.
You wrote that one of the glories of the Russian kitchen was baked cultured milk, and you wrote, it changed my life.
It did change my life. I was invited to Williams College for a job interview, and I was on my way to Moscow, and all I could think about was getting to Moscow. I really wasn't interested in getting a job. I just wanted to get to Moscow. But I went up to Williamstown, which is this small town in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. And there was a wonderful man teaching in the Russian department who his family had fled Russia. He was from an old aristocratic family. And I had the usual questions about critical theory and a theorist named Bakhtin, whom I'd written on in my dissertation. And then he turned to me and he said, "Can you tell me what is Varinets?" And I looked at him. He said, "I'd always heard about it, but I never knew what it was." And I said to him, "Oh, that is baked cultured milk." And he looked at me, and I think that's why I got the job.
I'm sure
it had nothing to do with critical theory.
So many of the recipes are so simple.
The Russians were cooking historically in these Russian masonry stoves. So if you can picture a pizza oven, you know, wood-burning oven, that is very, very big and also is heating the entire cottage that the peasants are living in. And you don't keep it just at its really hot peak and constantly fire it. You allow the temperature to continually drop. So when it's really hot, you bake the bread, you bake the pies, then you turn to doing braised vegetables and steamed grains. And when there's just very little residual temperature left, like you would make yogurt at, just enough warmth to activate the cultures, then you put milk in, really creamy, fresh whole milk, raw milk. Or you can use pasteurized milk if you want to. But you let it bake for how many hours did I say? About 3 hours, I think. And as a skin forms on top, you lift the skin off. That was used in haute cuisine for different kinds of very elegant desserts. But the milk caramelizes, it reduces. You know, it's like making dulce de leche, kind of. But then what you do is after you take it out, you stir the skin into the milk so that enhances the taste, but you take the final skin off and set it aside. Then once the milk is nearly cool, you stir in some yogurt or some, you could use kefir to culture that milk. So what you have is caramelized milk that also has been cultured and has this wonderful tang. And then you take the skin and you decorate the surface with it. And it's so rich and it's so beautiful. And that's a really good breakfast treat. Mm.
But you've sold me on it.
Mm-hmm. So can I mention it's not a recipe, but it's talking about the cultural traditions in Russia, which I was surprised at because I always think of Russians as being kind of dour and all of that kind of stuff. And you have a whole section in which titled "Lavish Hospitality," that they are the most entertaining. They'll share everything with you. You can't get away.
You can't get away, and they'll, you know, the shirt off their back kind of thing. And I just want to add that they really feel like guests are a gift from God. And in the immediate post-Soviet era, when the economy just crashed, it was very difficult for them because they couldn't regale people the way they wanted to. It's very heartfelt. Mm. One of the things that was important that the book be populated with smiling, kind faces to counteract that idea that the Russians are somehow mean and severe. I mean, there are some mean, severe people, as there are everywhere, but they're really wonderful.
We'll stop there and jump into chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Book is by Dara Goldstein. It's called Beyond the North Wind, Russia in Recipes and Lore. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, in the KSRO kitchen. Spending a lovely hour with Dara Goldstein this morning. Her new book, just out, 2020, Beyond the North Wind, Russia in Recipes and Lore. And we have worked our way. It's taken us long time.
We'll never make it to the end. It's okay. So, Zakuski. What are those? It sounds delicious. It's like banchan for the Koreans.
Exactly.
And what is it?
It's appetizers, and it's the hallmark of Russian dining. And anyone who goes to Russia, you encounter a table, and it's spread The idea, if you look at the cover of the book, mm-hmm. you see that there's mm-hmm. very little table surface that shows through. The idea is to create this sense of abundance, and it's very salty and sour and pickled and fermented things that will whet your appetite, that go really well with vodka. And it means little bites. So it's supposed to be the prelude to the meal. But if you don't know that, then it's as though it's an entire dinner before dinner.
I have to quote, well, I want you to quote from the pies, pancakes, and the dumplings section, what Chekhov had to say about blini.
Oh, you'll have to read it because I don't have the book in front of me.
Should be plump as the shoulders of a merchant's daughter, the blini. Because we think of these tiny little tortilla-sized blini.
And dry.
And it has a piece of badly smoked salmon on it. And that's the height of elegance at a cocktail reception. Yeah. So we just finished Maslenitsa, which is the Russian Butter Festival. The entire week of revelry before Lent and the Great Lenten Fast. And so in the West, you have Shrove Tuesday, you have Mardi Gras, you know, Single Tuesday. The Russians do a whole week of butter festivities.
That's my kind of festival.
That are focused on blini. And yes.
And you said they're saucer size.
They're saucer size. They're very porous because they're yeast raised. And so you get these nice pock marks on them and you pour butter into them, and they're just, I'm starting to salivate.
And do
they're
you,
delicious.
And you do them with caviar and things? Or you can do them with anything.
You can do them with anything. Yeah. I mean, you can put jam on them. I really love them just with butter and caviar and no other accoutrements, so the caviar comes through and you have that luxury. But salmon roe, you know, trout roe, you don't have to go for the expensive.
And thank you for mentioning paddlefish, because it's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Yes, I love it. And I won't, it's sad. I won't eat Caspian caviar anymore because the sturgeon is so endangered. But there's a lot of good roe being made in the United States, both wild paddlefish and also farmed here in California.
Chapter 4 is soups. And should we touch on borscht, John, or the classic cabbage soup? Anything
from that? So you talk about borscht and the history of borscht. It's not quite what I thought it was.
What did you think it was?
Well, I thought, you know, you take a bunch of beets and you roast them and you chop them up and you throw them in there. And it's not necessarily that at all. It can be a whole variety of other things. And typically, when I was growing up, we always ate it cold. Yeah. We never ate it hot.
Uh-huh. So borscht, I mean, there are hundreds of different styles, and they all have their own name. But it is originally a Ukrainian dish. I mean, it's widespread in Russia. I think it's considered Russian here because when there was the big emigration of Russian Jews in the late 19th century, they brought borscht with them, and it became identified with delis and with things Russian. But the classic Russian soup is cabbage soup. And there's this Russian saying, you know, cabbage soup and kasha, that is our food. I mean, it's what's most closely identified with who the Russians are.
So tell us what kasha is, because most people don't have a clue. They see it in the in the bulk bins and have no idea what to do with it.
Okay. So kasha is a generic term for porridge. But in the United States, kasha means buckwheat porridge. And buckwheat porridge is one of my favorite things in the world. I give lots of recipes for how to prepare it. You need to look for whole groats. Buckwheat's actually a grass. It's not a grain, but we treat it like a grain. And it has this amazingly beautiful, earthy, nutty flavor. You can make it like you do rice or any other grain on the stovetop. I like to bake it in the oven because it gets a lot fluffier. Sometimes if you do it on the stove and you have too much water, and if the groats aren't nice and big and whole, then it gets kind of sticky and unappealing, which might be some people's association to it.
It's interesting how important mushrooms are in this book.
Yes.
And apparently how important they were to the folks who gather them and buy them and pickle them and do all kinds of things with them.
Yeah, mushrooms are at the heart of Russian cuisine. gathered in the woods, gathered in fields, gathered from trees. There was this spoof in the early 1990s on a very hip TV station where they brought a talking head in who had this presentation that Lennon was a mushroom. And he had all these diagrams showing Lennon's head, you know, which looked like the cap of a mushroom, and he was comparing it to certain mushrooms. And the TV station was flooded with phone calls from anxious people who actually believed that he had been a mushroom.
Talk about gullible. Salads and vegetables, the roasted radishes with garlic and caraway. That's a starred recipe for me.
Oh, that's one of my favorite recipes in the book. So if you think the radishes are just to be eaten raw and, you know, with the crunch, roast them with a little bit of sunflower oil. Sunflower oil is really beautiful if you use the cold press stuff because it has, again, this nutty, earthy flavor. And the radishes shrivel a bit. They become mellow. They take on this beautiful deep pink color. And you add the garlic and caraway, and it's a beautiful side dish.
Love the photograph, too.
So can we go to the meat chapter? Because in there you have this wonderful discussion of the Russian stove, which I had no idea, which is this thing that's as big as a car.
Yeah.
And that people actually slept above it if you were infirm or
something. Yeah, or to keep, old with aching bones and rheumatism.
Keep you warm. And I loved it when you said that young Russians, they would tear them out of old places because they wanted to make room for their flat screen TVs and all that stuff. And then suddenly discovered they couldn't keep their house warm.
Yeah, and it's coming back because there's a restaurant in Moscow that is devoted to that kind of wood-burning cookery that is the way Russian cuisine developed, which is these constantly falling temperatures that I described earlier. And so you put dishes in at different times, and that really determined the pace and the nature of Russian cooking. I mean, one of the reasons that the Russians could do this was because one thing they had was a lot of wood. Mm-hmm. So in other parts of the world, fuel was scarce, and you tried to cook things really as quickly as possible. But in Russia, you had the fuel, so things could be, I mean, it's some of the original slow cooking.
Mm-hmm. In the fish section, which we just jumped over, there's a stunning photograph of this shaved salmon.
I know.
I've never seen anything like this.
Oh, that you're picking all my favorite recipes from the book. This is amazing because everyone loves, or not everyone, but a lot of people love sashimi. Mm-hmm. Think of this as Russian sashimi, except that they use a white fish there, but I call for salmon just because it's very readily available. So you take a chunk of salmon, stick it in the freezer. This is totally simple. And then once it's frozen, take it out, and with a very strong knife, and I have to say you need a very strong arm, you shave it into thin slices that curl as you shave. You know, it's like you shave wood and you get these curls. And when you bite into this frozen salmon, it hits your mouth, which is hot inside, or at least warm, and you have this sensation of the ice crystals on the salmon just popping in your mouth. And if you take the salmon and dip it in flavored salts, and I give, I think, really interesting recipes for charred salts that the Russians, again, have been making even before they knew about, you know, the properties of charcoal and what it might do for your health. It's really sensational. And in that regard, it's like what you were saying about New Nordic. I don't understand why people won't embrace New Russian, probably because it's Russian. But it's every bit as sophisticated as what they're doing in Scandinavia.
The other thing that I love here, it's like, if I can just get a piece of reindeer now, I will
yeah,
I'll do the same thing.
Well, we do it with venison. Yeah. Because we have fresh venison. It's really good with venison as well.
The oven braised veal stew with cherries. Mm. And you make the comment that Russians are wild about cherries and they show up in a lot of things. Sounds but part good. Of it is getting, we which we don't get here, we get wonderful sweet cherries.
Yeah. We don't get the sour.
We don't get the sour. You have to
order use them the special. Sour. Yeah, you can use the Morello cherries in jars that I think are pretty readily available.
Yeah, you point out you can get them at Trader Joe's.
Yes.
And then in the sweets category, I'd never heard of this bird cherry cake.
Yes, this is the cherry leitmotif. This is the most extraordinary. I tried to get Whole Foods to start carrying bird cherry flour because it is gluten-free and everyone's looking for the next gluten-free product. It is a bush that is sometimes a tree that is called the bird cherry. And these fruits are quite small, and they have lots of little seeds in them. And you dry them, and then you grind the cherries into a flour. And the taste is like cherry, almond, chocolate, because it's a very dark brown. And so you have this association with chocolate. And Kachka restaurant in Portland makes a bird cherry flour cake. And I want someone to start importing it into the United States because it's absolutely divine. And the way I learned to prepare it was with a frosting that is made by whipping high-fat sour cream, which will whip into beautiful peaks like fresh cream will. I mean, your regular dairy case sour cream will not whip that way, so you have to look for the high-fat. But then mixing it with a lingonberry puree that's bright pink, and it's just you have all these berry flavors.
And we're down to about a minute or so in the dessert section. I did want to reference the baked apple with the caramel sauce and then puffed, is it buckwheat? And I saw a couple high-end chefs doing this recently. This is becoming popular, this puffed buckwheat around.
Yeah, it's like popcorn. Like so popcorn. You just throw the groats in 30 seconds, if that.
Yeah, all kinds of grains you can do that with. Oh. With quinoa and things like that you can get.
Anything
rhubarb
else?
Pudding.
Yes.
Mm. It's such a simple recipe. And it sounds, partly because I grew up with rhubarb and I just love it so much.
But I love it too. And it's called kisel, which is from the Russian word for sour. And these are, there are many, many different puddings like this. The original one was made with oatmeal. I like it better with fruit.
Well, we made it to the end of the desserts. Now, Dara, your final duty this morning is to give us your favorite number between 1 and 12.
Oh, I remember this exercise, and it's always fraught for me. I will say 11.
Call it? Boy, that's wild.
Our poor producer.
Yeah. Sorry, Mike. Call it number 11 at 636-1350. We'll win this autographed copy of Beyond the North Wind, Russia in Recipes and Lore. You're such a beautiful writer, and the stories are so evocative. They're so colorful. You make this region of Russia, which none of us, I don't think, have ever even thought existed, come alive. So I'm glad the publisher talked you into writing another book.
Thank you so much. It's really been a joy to talk to you. You're always so lively.
Thank you, Dara Goldstein, for coming in today.
Thank you.
Chef John Ash next week.
Yes, sir.
Steve Garner for the KSRO Good Food Hour. Thanks for listening.